or something. But, and I realized that when it's a birthday party in honor of a distinguished Japanese professor, that I'm not even on the same planet of politeness or grace. So I'll just say happy birthday to Dr. Hirota and then carry on with my talk. So my talk is about additive extensions of quantum channels, and that doesn't sound like anything, but so I'll tell you what that is, and it's joint work with Graham Smith, here as part three of IBM Day here at the Perimeter Institute. All right, so this is just my outline of what I'm going to talk about. First, I'll tell you what a quantum channel is. I guess I probably won't take my whole hour because the beginning of this talk, most of you sure already know, but I should stretch it for the 5 minutes that Chris is gone. Talk about what capacities are in the additivity problem, and then present some bounds that have been known for a while, and then tell you about, finally get to the actual topic of this talk, which is additive extensions, and a special case of them called degradable extensions, and then try to explain how you get new bounds on the quantum capacity and various other capacities sometimes by using these new channels, extensions. And finally, at the end, if there's time, I can show a relation to some other work that is at least slightly amusing. All right, so everybody knows this slide. You can't give a talk on the, I got a referee report or an editor's report from the IEEE that says an information theory paper does not have a conclusion. And they never said this because they never had to, but I think also all information theory papers have to start with this. But to me, all I want to point out about the Shannon capacity is that it's very remarkable that it works and that it's a single letter formula that doesn't need regularization. Quantum channels are very different. Here is an actual quantum channel as labeled in Charlie's handwriting. This was the first quantum cryptography experimental apparatus, and we had a very nice secret channel about a foot long. That's a centimeter to most of you, 30 centimeters. Sorry, foot, centimeter. This, all right, and so of course, we write channels mathematically as trace preserving completely positive maps in the Schrodinger picture, so we're being careful. And you can write down the Gaussian operators. But I don't think I need to dwell on this. Another way to talk about them is an isometry, which is the way I prefer to think of things, because I don't so much care for the word isometry. But everything in quantum mechanics is unitary, so I have a U in the middle, except that you might change the dimensions by having some extra input in a known state and some part of the output that doesn't go all the way through. And so that is the most general sort of quantum operation, and it's what I call a quantum channel. And this picture will come back to haunt us a little later.
Oh, you missed the good part.
Can you say it again?
Happy birthday, Robert. Quantum channel, you know what that is. And you're both. Okay. Pretty much. And then all the stuff we said about you. All right, so then the channel capacity for quantum capacity channels, of course, been known for a while and evaluated in terms of the coherent information. So the coherent information is the smallest hockey stick I've ever seen. So the coherent information is defined usually for a state as just the entropy that Bob has minus the entropy of the whole bipartite system.
I'm not really, strong enough to point to that little stick.
But you can also define the coherent information for a channel and a state. So you take the channel, apply it to a purification of the state and the identity on the other half of the purification, and this is how you define the coherent information for a channel. And then you can define a capacity, which we call the Q1, which is just the maximum coherent information that you can get through the channel with one use of the channel. And that's the thing that is sort of vaguely analogous to the mutual information for channel theory, yeah? No, there's no dumb questions, just dumb people. Not necessarily you, but
I've been waiting to say that for a while.
Well done. Sorry. I'm glad to be the straight man for that.
What's the question?
If the left side, if S of rho B is smaller than S of rho AB, does it have negative coherent information, or does it just go to zero at that point?
No, it's negative.
Oh, yeah, it's negative. Okay.
Although I suppose for the capacity, you should say it's the max of the zero. This is zero and that. But the coherent information itself can't be negative.
Well, if you find the right state, you can always get a state that has zero coherent information.
Oh, that's true. This max already saves you from that. That's true. If you put a product state in it, you'll never get a negative coherent information. So that's what you're saying.
So that was a sensible question.
Well, yeah,
which leaves
the other possibility.
So that's a coherent
So this sort of looks like the Shannon formula, because you max over some sort of input distribution or state in this case. And
you get something that looks like a capacity. But the problem is, of course, that it's not the capacity, and you have to regularize it. So regularization just means I take this one-shot capacity, but I apply it to a channel constructed out of the tensor product of many uses of the channel I'm actually interested in, and I then divide that number by n and take the limit as n goes to infinity. And that's the sort of most general thing you can do with this. Well, maybe not the most general, but the right thing to do. In other words, it's just the limit of 1 over n times this one-shot capacity on many uses of the channel, where I remind you what the one-shot capacity is. And that's actually the capacity. And the problem is that there really are channels that you have to do this regularization for. There's no one-shot capacity. And that makes it hard to find out what the capacity actually is. You can't calculate it because it's sort of, you know, this limit goes to infinity, and you have to do bigger and bigger things. Even numerically, you're kind of sunk, and it's kind of ugly.
A one-shot expression in terms of some other information function? Or has there been
everybody but Graham
find a better huge function?
What was your answer?
Everybody but Graham gave up.
No, they didn't give up right away.
Well,
we tried quite a while after this was proven.
But we actually now know that there's very few candidates that are even possible. But we'll get to that. I'm not sure if that's in here. But all right, so for the most part, you're stuck with this regularized model.
And that leaves you with all sorts of additivity questions, I guess. I've been mentioned several times with the additivity of the entanglement of formation, the classical capacity, the minimum output entropy, the output rank, which I think all of these are related except the output rank, or even that one might be. Is that one of the ones, Peter? That's the same? The output rank and then, no, it's not the same. Or that one's maybe not even additive. All right, so it's not the same. But all of these, except I guess this one, might be additive, we just don't know. However, the quantum capacity is just plain not single letter. And so we should stop trying to prove that it is, I suppose. And that's bad because it means you can't calculate things, but it's good because it means there's lots of papers to write and things to calculate. And so we decide to work on that. So a channel that you use a lot, of course, is the depolarizing channel, which you can write in various forms, which are useful at various times. But essentially, it's the channel that takes your state and then completely randomizes it some of the time and otherwise leaves it alone. So that's written this way. With 1 minus p at a time, it leaves it alone, and otherwise it applies one of the Pauli matrices. You can also write it as a mixture of the original state with the identity and calculate the relation between this x and that p if you want. And it has the property that it's symmetric under doing a unitary transformation before or after the channel, which are all sort of the nice things about it. And so it's a channel that you think you might be able to know the capacity of and really understand. So one thing we know about the capacity of the depolarizing channel is that at 50% depolarization probability, it has zero capacity. And this can be seen because of a no cloning argument. a channel like this, where Alice puts various things into the channel, and then half the time they get sent to the eavesdropper, and the other half the time they get sent to Bob. And although I haven't drawn it, whenever Bob gets one, whenever the data is sent to Eve instead of Bob, Bob gets some completely random state, an identity, a density matrix. That channel is a symmetric depolarizing channel, and the argument is that whatever Alice could do to somehow encode the information, the quantum information, to get it through the channel to Bob, well, Eve is in exactly a symmetric situation. She can say, well, I have exactly the same thing Bob does, so you must have also gotten the quantum information to me. But we know that quantum information can't be cloned, so this must be impossible. So this channel has to have zero capacity. Like here I indicated that quantum information can't be cloned, and I remind you that classical information can, with Dolly, the cloned sheep, who I used to always have a picture of, but I don't at the moment. So I just put in HTML dollies with tags, as it were. All right, so the no cloning bound can actually be improved. The 50% depolarizing probability corresponds to a P number from the previous slide of 3/8. And surprisingly, this cloner I showed of just half the time giving things to Eve and half the time to Bob is not the optimal cloner. So if you actually use the optimal cloner, you can refine this argument and get that the capacity goes to zero at P equals 0.25 instead of P equals 3/8. And for a long time, this was kind of the best known bound. And then you also get to draw this straight line of the quantum capacity versus the depolarization probability because we thought it was true and didn't really prove it correctly. But luckily, we've sort of saved that with modern results. But we always drew the line anyway. It's true, but it wasn't true years ago when we started drawing it. So the capacity has to be below that line. The other good bound that's been around for quite a while is the Rain's bound. And that bound is just 1 minus the binary entropy of P. And this bound has been around, I forget, since maybe about 1998 or 99, a pretty long time. And I never understood the paper. But it provides sort of a nice bound. But the problem is it's kind of weak around here. And annoyingly, it's stronger than the straight line over here. So you have to draw this annoyingly complicated function of taking the lower of these two lines. And that's the actual bound that's been around. So, all right. So that's sort of what was known until recently. And then I'm going to explain the new concept of the additive extension. So an additive extension of a channel is just some other channel that if you throw away part of it in some way, you apply some third channel to it, you get back the original channel. So in this picture, you have a channel N that you would like to find an additive extension of. Here, T is the additive extension. It's a little confusing in the picture because it's small and lives inside N, so it's sort of funny because it's a bigger channel. But what I mean is I take this channel T and I apply some extra channel after it, and the two channels together make the original channel. So, I mean, an extension of a channel could be I have my channel, and I have another channel, and I throw away the other channel. That gives me back the original channel. But T is supposed to also have the property that it has a single letter formula for its capacity, and that was what makes it an additive extension. And then we also define the concept of a degradable extension, which is the same thing except the where T is also degradable. And I'll tell you what a degradable channel is, if you don't know. One of these slides. Maybe here. Okay, a degradable channel is one where there's some map that if you apply that map to the output of the channel, you get what the environment has. So you can find out exactly what the environment has. So in my isometry picture, a degradable channel is one where I can apply some map to here and get exactly what had gone into the sometimes it's called the complementary channel is what goes from Alice to Eve. And similarly, there's an anti-degradable channel which has the other property, that Eve can get exactly what Bob has. And the nice thing about degradable channels is that it was shown that they have single letter quantum capacities. So that's really important because nothing else is known to really, and that's very handy. Unfortunately, the channel we really want to know about, the depolarizing channel, is not degradable. So the game is going to be to try and use what we know about degradable channels to prove something about non-degradable channels, but that are related to them in some way. No, it's a single letter coherent information.
So it's all just sort of done for those. The problem is we don't know too many degradable channels, but they'll be there. All right, so the reason we're interested in these additive extensions is they really turn out to be pretty simple to understand. They're additive, and they provide single letter additive bounds on the quantum capacity.
And they include all the other known bounds that we already have as special cases. And my favorite part is that I can get the Reynolds bound without ever having to learn what his paper is actually about. And then when they're degradable, they also bound the private capacity, which is nice because there aren't really any other bounds on the private capacity. And they have good convexity properties, which fixes that straight line, among other things. And the bounds that you get are also tighter than the ones we had before. All right, so the first step of this is what I call the embarrassingly simple theorem. It wasn't called that in the paper, but when I started trying to give a talk on it, I was embarrassed by how simple the theorem was.
Well, you already have a remarkable theorem. So this is just bad.
So if T is an additive extension of N,
of some channel N, then the quantum capacity of the channel N is bounded by the one-shot quantum capacity of T. And if it's also degradable, the same thing bounds the private capacity. So here's the embarrassingly simple proof. Well, I can, this Q1 of T is its true capacity is the same as its one-shot capacity for T, because by definition, it was an additive extension, so that has to be true. And then the
capacity of N is less than or equal to the capacity of T, because you can just get N from T by applying the map, who by definition takes T to N. And so if you happen to have this channel, and you for some reason you thought that the capacity of N was higher, well, you'd just say, well, I have T, but I like N better, so I'll degrade T into N and then use that. So the theorem is utterly trivial. Maybe it should be a lemma or demoted to a, I don't know, a fact. What's the weakest thing? Observation is good, yeah. Anyway, but it's like, you know, theorem three in the paper. And also, you can make this is also true for CP using the slightly less trivial fact that the private capacity is additive for degradable channels that Brown Smith showed. All right, so now I'm going to define something and make a lemma about it, which is also pretty embarrassingly simple. So suppose we have some degradable channel that is just, or we have some channel that is a convex mixture of other channels, each of which is degradable. Then I want to define a T, which is the same mixture, except that for each term in the mixture, there's an extra system that comes out for the receiver, which is in an orthonormal basis of I's that tells you which one you have. So we call that a flag, and it's a flagged degradable extension. Oh yeah, it's called a flag, see? The lemma is that this thing is in fact a degradable extension of N. So in order to show that, I need to show it's an extension of N, and also that it's additive, and in fact degradable. It's an extension of N because I just throw away the flag system and I get N back by taking the trace. And it's degradable because each piece in the sum is degradable, and Bob finds out which one he has. And so in order to find out what the environment would have had, in other words, to degrade it, he just looks at the flag, and then he applies the appropriate degrading map based on which flag you have. So this is an extension, and it's degradable. So I'm going to use this to get a nice bound, the convex combination bound, which is going to be about mixing together channels, and each of which is additive or degradable, and then getting a bound on the channel that I'm actually interested in. So the theorem is that if T is a flag degradable extension of a channel N, then the capacity of the channel is less than the individual one-shot capacities of the things that I'm making it out of. So I can prove that in a pretty straightforward way. So phi is some state that is the optimal input state to achieve the capacity of the channel T, or the one-shot capacity of the channel T, which is the same as its actual capacity. And then I'm just going to write down the capacity formula, which is just the coherent information. And there's no longer a maximization because phi is already the maximum one. And so it's just the entropy of what Bob has minus the entropy of what Eve has. That's the coherent information. This hat means the complementary channel. So it's just what Bob gets and what Eve gets and take the difference. Then that equals this, which is, well, it's straightforward. You just calculate the entropies. Because these things are orthogonal, the entropies of the individual pieces just add up, and you also get the entropy of the flags. And that cancels because there's another entropy of the flags on the other term. And so you end up with this thing. And then this looks very much like just the coherent information of the individual pieces, the NIs, averaged over how often they occur, except that phi isn't the optimal thing for each NI, it was the optimal thing for the whole thing. So if you put in the true optimal for each one, it bounds what this is, and well, you're done. So you can take convex mixtures of things and get new bounds. So for example, the no cloning bounds are going to be a special case of this convex mixture bound. So I'll show that just to show this thing off. So the no cloning bound, another way to say it is that you have an anti-degradable channel, it will have zero capacity. So let's consider some anti-degradable channel, which just means that there's some degrading map on its complementary channel that gives you back the original channel. And it's, let's say its isometry is called U, and it maps some system A to a Bob and an Eve putt. Well, then I'm going to define this new isometry V, which just is a superposition of applying U to the origin, to the input state, and setting a flag for Bob and a flag for Eve, or swapping what Bob and Eve gets and setting the flags the other way. So this channel is degradable and anti-degradable by symmetry, but it was originally degradable when I just symmetrized it. And it's zero capacity because it's symmetric. And I can get the reason this is supposed to be an additive extension of the original channel, and that's because I can get the original channel by applying the anti-degrading map only when necessary, because the Bob gets a flag about whether he has the original channel or the swapped version. So that just immediately recovers the no cloning bound, but it's not very interesting. What makes me more happy is to recover the Rains bound. And so to get that, what you have to observe is that if I have a dephasing channel and I apply a random unitary chosen over the Haar measure, for example, and it's inverse before and after the dephasing channel, I get a depolarizing channel. And you can calculate what value of polarization you get for a particular amount of dephasing, and it's actually just P. So this whole thing is just a depolarizing channel with a polarization P. So in other words, I've said depolarizing channels are convex mixtures of dephasing channels. Dephasing channels are degradable channels, and we know their capacity. And convex mixtures bound the capacity of channels The convex mixture bound from that proved a couple of slides ago just gets us the Reinsen bound immediately, because you can make a torsion channel out of degradable channels. But it gets better than this. The bound that I proved before, it's actually better than convex. So if T is a flag degradable extension, well, its capacity of N is, well, I think it should be a less than or equal. Yeah. Yeah, this should be an inequality, not an equal. Yeah.
What's the capacity for a defacing channel with probability B? Is it simple?
Well, it's just the entry 1 minus the entry, binary entry of
B. Okay, so it is the range.
Yeah, it's just right there. Okay. Just looking at you. That's what's nice about it. All right, so what I want to say here is that
I have a slightly better bound than before. And this should look familiar, because this is exactly what was on a previous slide, where I went through and I eventually get to that the capacity is bounded by Q1. And I want this to be a tighter bound. And the thing is that when I went through this before, there's this step here where I said, all right, these look kind of like the Q1s of each individual n sub I, but evaluated at a phi that was best for the entire mixture T, not for the individual ones. And I said, well, that makes this thing bigger than that. I say, well, all right, forget it. Why am I making the bound weaker on purpose? So let's just stop. And you have a slightly tighter bound than you had before. In other words, instead of bounding it by finding the individual Q1 capacities of the things in the mixture, you can just bound it by those individual capacities, but not at their optimal point, at the point that was optimal for their mixture, which may or may not be easy to calculate, but at least it's a tighter bound. And it turns out sometimes you can calculate it, and it gets us tighter bounds, which we're going to get by using, instead of, we're going to make a depolarizing channel again, but instead of making it out of mixtures of defacing channels, we're going to make it out of mixtures of general degradable channels. So it was shown that this is the most general degradable channel up to a local, well, up to a unitary operation on qubits. And it's degradable whenever sine v is less than cosine u. And if you make sine v equals sine u, like a couple of these terms go to zero, and it looks like the amplitude damping channel. And when you're at some other extreme, it looks like the defacing channel, but you get a one parameter family in between. Right? It looks like two parameters, but they have to be related. And so I don't go through it in great detail, but you can make a depolarizing channel. This is by mixing together these general degradable channels in various ways, and then applying a random unitary, or in this case, I'm just going to apply a random Clifford operation, which amounts to the same thing, and it's easier to write. And then here I've made a flagged mixture instead of just a regular mixture. And the depolarization you get when you make this mixture, well, it's this function, and you have to sort of maximize over u and v. Yeah, you get a family of bounds for different u's and v's that of different ways of decomposing the polarizing channel. But you just do the best one, and you find out that you get this, where you get this result, that the quantum capacity of a depolarizing channel with depolarization p is the convex hull of these three numbers of various levels of complexity. Well, one of them is the old Reinsen bound, which is best in a certain region. One of them is the old no-cloning straight line, which is also best in a certain region, annoyingly. And one of them is the new result, which is a little ugly, but it's a thing. And it's not that bad. It's just two binary entropy functions and this funny square root thing. And I mean, it's not hard to show that this is true. And so you can plot it. And this is the old bound, which is just the straight line or the Reinsen bound, whichever is lower. But now we know that you take the best of these three things in each region and then take the smooth convex hull of it. And that gives this new bound And then this other line is the achievable rate that you can achieve with the best known quantum error correcting codes. So there's still a lot of room for improvement.
Center thing with the gammas and supers. The new
no, near one end, it's really the straight line, and near the other
end.
Oh,
one end, right? One end is a straight line. It's
yeah.
Like, it just kind of becomes
I guess up at the top is a straight line, and down the bottom is the range bound, and it varies. Well, I forget, there was something. I think that's actually not true. I think that. I forget. There was some. I think that is true, but the difference is so tiny that it doesn't show up if you plot it on the same scale. You can't see the difference anyway.
Well, it must be the case, otherwise you would have well, thrown out those other two pieces.
Right, exactly.
John? So the region between, there's this region around p equals 0.2 to 0.25, where you can't prove the capacity is zero, but we don't have any way of achieving any capacity at this point.
Right.
Is there any, I mean, what's the sort of speculative status of that? People think that that's zero, or we have no idea at all?
Well, different people have different guesses, I suppose. I think I sort of want them to be achievable all the way up to 0.25, but it's pretty hopeless to see how to get there. At least all the codes we've known. This point, if you do just random coding, or think of the Q1 capacity of the Bayes channel, which you can calculate, it goes to zero about here. And we've nudged it up with degenerate codes by like 1 part 10 to the 4th or something like that. Maybe it's 1 part 10 to the 3rd now, but not very far. And in order to do that, you need to calculate very big things that are hard to calculate. And we just don't have any mechanism to do it. But sort of every time you calculate something bigger, it moves another, you know, 1 part 10 to the 6th or something. So it's like, am I moving close to 0.25 or am I asymptotically getting stuck? I just have no idea. And we don't know how to make any bound to show it's zero, except this is just basically a no-calling bound that goes to zero. Well, that doesn't seem to show any signs of budging either. I guess the continuity result helps a little, but not really. All right, so well, another result that you can get by essentially playing the same game but with a different channel than the polarizing channel is to bound the private capacity of the PDA4 channel. Which is the channel that is, it's like the polarizing channel, but has independent x's and z's, and the y doesn't have its own probability. It's just the square of the probabilities of the other two. And this channel has the same private capacity as the Ben Broussard 84 on key distribution protocol that can only allow one-way processing. So that's a sort of useful channel to study, and the bounds on it have been ugly, typically, and we have this new tighter and slightly less ugly bound,
which is this thing. And you get that really just from mixing together amplitude damping channels in the right way to get the BB84 channel, which you can get just with this mixture. You have one amplitude damping channel and another one where you've just changed to the Y basis. And that's a degradable extension of the BB84 channel. And it's nice since it only has two terms, it's actually pretty easy to calculate what its Q1 is, and it's additive and degradable, so it bounds the private capacity. So that's really all for additive and degradable extensions, except for one last observation that this relates to some other work sort of an amusing way, I guess. The symmetric side channel assisted capacity. It's one of these assisted capacities that seems really funny, but has nice properties. And we wrote about, a couple of years ago, and eventually it will come out in IEEE. It's 2 or 3 years for these things. And so this is basically you take a channel and you give an assistance channel that happens to itself have zero capacity. And the capacity, that assisted capacity is additive, which is why we like it. And so the thing you add is an isometry that, well, it's symmetric between the bob and the eavesdrop. And so you can, instead of an isometry, you can write it as a channel, which is just take the isometry, apply it to the density matrix, and like that. And it has a quantum capacity of zero because it's symmetric. And it's this assisted capacity is just defined in a sort of a funny way. It looks like it's regularized because this n is to the n, but you only get sort of one copy of the assisted channel. So you have, you know, lots and lots of uses of the channel that you're studying, but you just get this one symmetric assisted channel. And what we showed in 2006, along, this is Smith and me and Andreas Winter, what we showed is that this is additive. So it's SS capacity of the channel is just the Q1 capacity of this thing. And so what I want to show here is that the channel tensor product, this assistance funny channel, is actually an additive extension of the original channel. And with capacity that is equal to the resisted capacity of the channel. So the thing is, if I simply say, well, what's the capacity of n cross A? Well, I have to do this regularization. It's the Q1 of n copies of n and n copies of A, which isn't quite what I want, because the QSS is defined without a NA to the n here. So to show that this thing is actually an additive extension, it just takes a little work. And so all you do is you say, okay, well, what, let, I want to know the capacity of n cross A. That's this limit with the regularization. And then I'm going to play a trick, which is to pull this out into two pieces. Because what I know about the SS capacity is that it's additive. It's not just single letter, but it's additive when used between two different channels. So I'm going to make the, I'm going to pull out one factor of A and then say, okay, well, this thing is just the Q1 of my channel N times tensor A. And then I'm just playing the distributive law. I also have the A to the one less use tensor A. And this one A hanging around makes it additive. And this term has zero capacity. And this term is additive, so I get to pull out an N and get just an N cross A here. And since that equals the one-shot capacity of the whole thing. In other words, this thing has capacity equal to its one-shot capacity. So N cross A is an additive extension of N. So sort of everything that was known before about down some things, including the SS capacity work, is all special cases of additive extension. That's sort of, oh good, a question. I ran out of things to say.
To pull out the other part?
No, an additive extension doesn't have to be strongly additive, but the SS capacity is strongly additive, so I can pull it out. But the additive extension just has to have a single letter formula. Uh-huh. Yeah, and unfortunately, I for years now, and other people picked it up probably, that saying additivity and single letterness of a formula are sort of used interchangeably, but they don't really mean the same thing. So I try to be specific now, sometimes fail. Well, so anyway, that's the end, fall off the end of the earth here. So. I have to pass this on to Ms. Summer.